Hello, everybody. I'm Danny Boom Boom McCarthy.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway, and I saw above me that endless skyway, I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me.
Welcome, everybody, to the Story of Nowhere podcast. I am your host, as always, Daniel McCarthy. Episode 30 here, so that's pretty cool. Thank you all for listening thus far, and I hope for continuing to listen on into the future. I also want to thank those of you who have checked out the Nowhere Library and have seen what I've got for sale there. If you're not sure what I'm talking about, listen to the bonus show I've got posted before this episode, and you'll hear all about the launch of my brand new online bookstore. Actually, everything you need to know about my online bookstore, including that bonus show, and including the bookstore itself, can all be found at storyofnowhere.com/library. If you want to financially aid this show, that would be a great way to do it. Plus, you get a book out of the deal. Not bad, right? And of course, you can always also purchase a copy of the book that I wrote, which always makes me feel nice. But to very abruptly change the subject from all this talk about sales and products and such, today's show is about private property. Certainly, private property is a foundational concept in modern political philosophy. Whether you love private property or hate private property, if you're going to have a political theory, you're going to have to say something about private property. I am, generally, in favor of private property. Today's guest, generally speaking, is not. You may recall that back in episode 23, the Political Spectrum Show, I complained that political discussions always start in the middle, already in progress, too far up the tree, if you will. That is to say, they don't start where they should, with the fundamentals. Political discussions always seem to start with somebody making some smart-ass comment about some detail having to do with a bill or a news story or a political figure. Then somebody else has to retort with a counter-smart-ass comment about how the other guy just doesn't care about X, or how your side is full of pedophiles and rapists and my side totally isn't, or how the experts I like agree with me, therefore you're racist. Then the whole thing just descends into a horror show where fully grown and ostensibly responsible adults employ the rhetorical tactics of middle schoolers just to seem smarter and more virtuous than the other guy. You know how it goes. You've seen it happen a million times. No point is ever actually addressed. No argument is ever actually dealt with. It's just a typhoon of logical fallacies, name-calling, grandstanding, and ignorance. Oh, and making shit up. Don't forget making shit up. That is key. But anyway, these kinds of political discussions, if you can call them that, are really just a waste of time, and a waste of precious cortisol. They're a waste because they just dance around topical details and never really get at anything fundamental. They never challenge, or for that matter, they never affirm, the underlying assumptions upon which these details are based. So that's why today, you'll hear my guest and I discuss property, as in, is property, as an idea and as an enforceable practice, legitimate? That's pretty damn fundamental, so I'd like to thank my guest for suggesting the topic. And even though the two of us are coming at this issue from opposite sides, we managed to get through the whole conversation without ripping each other's hair out or resorting to lies, misrepresentations, or name-calling. So, you know, rational conversation about important ideas may not be the recipe for a popular show, but nonetheless, I think it's a recipe for a good show. I hope you'll agree. Naturally, the subject of property and whether or not it's legitimate is huge, far bigger than we could cover in this one episode. In fact, if you just look at the history of the property debate, you find that, actually, this is one of those debates that's apparently needed to rage for several hundred years, at least. Of course, there's a ton more that I wanted to say about property from my perspective, and I'm sure that my guest feels the same way. In fact, I know he does, because we've already discussed the possibility of picking the subject up again sometime. Consider this an introduction to the great property debate. One last thing before I leave you to it. I want to say a word about my guest, Jay Clark. He is a fiction author. You can purchase his book, No Bottom Road, which I recommend you do. I enjoyed it a great deal. And it also covers some of the philosophical ground you'll hear us discuss today. But Jay doesn't have a store or anything at the moment, so for now, if you want to get a copy of his book, send an email to storyofnowhere@mail.com, the same email address on my website's contact page, and I'll set you up with a book. Also, I suppose this may be somewhat irregular for this kind of podcast, but Jay is my father-in-law, which is great for me because it means that we've got to have these kinds of discussions for years now. And I suppose I should count myself as lucky, because I know, especially around this time of year, the holidays, people can go crazy over the wild political arguments and fights with insane family members. So I'm lucky that what you're about to hear is the sort of political, philosophical discussion that I get to have. So, be jealous if you're so inclined. With that said, I hope you all enjoy it, and let's get to it. All right. We begin. So, my guest today is Jay Clark, an author, a proletarian, a college grad, and my father-in-law. So this ought to be pretty interesting. So today we're going to talk about a fairly fundamental concept concerning political philosophy. But before we get into that, I would like you to introduce yourself to the good people out there. So tell them a little about yourself and what you've been working on.
Hey, good people. I'm a writer, I think, above all those other things, and finishing up a second novel. I've been building a cabin, which has given me a lot of time to think. And today I'd like to talk about property. Because I'm building the cabin on 100 acres of property that I've inherited from my grandmother that is 500 miles away in Ontario, Canada, which is another country. And I do try to justify that to myself. But I think I'm on a really slippery footing when I claim that I own that 100 acres. So that's one way we approach this whole thing. Can you justify private property as a precondition for human happiness? It's one of the fundamental assumptions of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. It's been one of the fundamental assumptions for most European philosophers in the last, since the Renaissance, anyway. Most, not Rousseau, though. So my feeling is, where Dan and I have had a conversation many times in the past is, Dan always argues against government when we have our conversations, against government because it is coercion. Government with taxation, say.
Sure.
Is coercion.
I like the, not to cut you off, but I like the Max Weber classic definition. I think it's pretty good. The state is the, it's the monopoly on the legitimate use of force in a given area.
Yeah.
Monopoly on force.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So we could argue about legitimate, but
now,
set that aside.
But here's where we're going is, do you believe that there is a right to that property without government, without that monopoly on force?
I do.
This is where we have an interesting conversation.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely. And may I say, an absolutely fundamental and crucial conversation to have. Most political conversations that people get into often tend to be dealing with some, in the larger scheme of things, very small issue. You know, we're always debating about this political figure or maybe a bill in particular or some small aspect of some policy or whatever. It's all very set within an Overton window that in the United States is very limited, I think. Very seldom do you hear a conversation that goes to the bedrock of all of our political assumptions. And so I think in talking about property, we are actually going back to the basics. Before we're going to talk about, I like the Democrats, I like the Republicans, or whatever, wherever we want to go, we have to have some kind of answer to this property question. Because really, I think any political ideology is going to have to contend with the concept of property.
I think so. Agree? Like, absolutely.
To affirm or deny, right?
Yes. And, I mean, Marx says communism is the abolition of property.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a communist, but I question property because I believe you have to have coercion, violence, threats of violence, potential violence in order to hold property.
Okay.
Very simple. If I see a piece of land and I stake it out and I put strings around it, this is Rousseau, and I say, this is mine, what happens when the next person steps over my string and says, well, I'm going to put my little garden plot right here. And do I, having put the string around there, do I have any right to tell him he can't? And if I do have a right to tell him he can't, how do I stop him? Force.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. And so the issue then would be, to what extent does mixing one's labor with a resource actually convert it into property? And then how much force are you allowed in a given situation to use to defend your property? But before we get into all of these tangential issues, let's define property.
Very good.
What is this thing we're talking about? You posed the subject, so what's your definition of property? What do you want to work with today?
Well, I think I'd like to talk mostly about land property or other property that that you can't tote around with you. It's been defined many times. The closer an item is to you and your immediate well-being, the more it is yours. And the further it is from you and not immediate to your well-being, the less it is yours. And like on a spectrum, relative to distance, which is like, I like to go back to the 100 acres of woodlands 500 miles away.
Yes.
And my right to own that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I'm mostly interested in land because it's fundamental. You can grow food on land. And it's not the obvious thing where if you come up and take something out of somebody's pocket, that's theft. Right?
Okay.
But if you pitch your tent on somebody else's land, what is that? Is that trespass? Mm-hmm. Is trespass a legitimate, philosophically legitimate? And like when I talk philosophically, I'm always thinking about what would be in the best interests of humankind if we could reorder the way we operate to the greatest happiness for all.
Okay.
I mean, I think that's a common philosophical goal, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so let me see if I can stumble through this idea and frame it as a question.
Okay.
If we, for the sake of argument, deny that there is any legitimacy in the ownership of land, you can't own land, it doesn't make any sense. If we get rid of that concept, then on what basis can anyone stop anybody from doing anything anywhere. For instance, if there's a group of people living on the land, and we're claiming that the land cannot be owned, and then another group, say, on ships, comes over and starts chopping trees down and building settled communities and cabins and instituting religions and perhaps driving people off of land in order to pursue what they consider to be the greater good, right? They're working from some conception, for the sake of argument, of godliness or progress or whatever. If there's no property right in that land itself, what is to make their actions and their impositions any more or less just than the people who are just living off the land naturally?
Well, my answer to that would be what I always say to people who defend the European invasion of the Americas, is that it was an invasion. Why was it conducted as an invasion? On initial contact, the native people in America were not the aggressors. When you go to somebody's house, do you knock on the door, wait to be invited in, act as a guest? Maybe you end up living in the house, maybe not. But Europeans came to this continent and knocked the door down, came in, poisoned everybody, and started living in it. And the people that they didn't poison, they had to go live in the backyard. So was it legitimate?
That's the question.
Yeah. And it was only possible with use of force. So, because I want to keep force as a leverage in this whole thing. Be aware of it all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I would agree. So, personally, from my point of view, the reason, well, let's not say the reason, a major reason that I think that the European conquest of the Americas was in fact illegitimate was largely because, we haven't quite gotten to this yet, but essentially the Europeans were violating the intrinsic property rights of the natives, as I conceive of it. And this was an argument they had at the time. It's very interesting to read, and I talked a little bit about this in a previous show that I did, where, you know, basically once the English found the northern part of the continent, people were just clamoring to figure out some justification to colonize it, right? And they had all these different theories, and basically the one that wound up winning out was John Locke and his idea of mixing labor. All that stuff, which, I don't know. How deep are we going to be able to get?
But that was BS. We can go all the way down there.
Sure. Okay.
That was BS because the native people were mixing labor all the time.
Totally.
So, they were active husbands of the land, if you want to use that expression.
And so that's it. I 100% agree with that. And so as far as I'm concerned, and to the extent that I agree with John Locke, I think that the natives actually were exercising the phenomenon of property.
And so this was theft.
This was theft.
Okay.
100%.
Yeah.
All right.
Now, the point I would like to make, and I didn't want to get right to my Native American friends so fast, but the point to make is especially in the lands that the English invaded. It was a little different to the Southwest where the Spanish invaded, but where the English invaded, those Indians of the Northeast and of the North had almost no concept of property besides your shelter, which was movable, transient, your clothes, your immediate food, and all resources. This is where I would like to get back, because I was just reading an essay this afternoon. The reason you gathered resources or improved things, the reason you worked on things, was for the good of everybody. That was the way. You didn't own it. You shared it. And it was a working culture for thousands of years. I mean, with problems, like everybody has. And this is one of the reasons I've come up against this problem of property rights. Because it's a foreign idea to the people who were here for thousands of years. They found footprints, I think in Arizona or New Mexico, 21 to 23,000 years old, human footprints, teenagers, they think. People have been on this continent for a long time. And we have a, this is another one of the European ways of taking ownership, not only of the land, but of the history of the storyline. We pretend history doesn't exist. Like, the only history that is worth anything goes back 5,000 years, and it all started in, not in Africa, but in the Middle East, you know, in
right.
Israel.
Right.
That's the whole Judeo-Christian religion, which is hugely disrespectful for almost every other tradition. But particularly for people who lived over here, where if you imagine, they separated themselves out, and I wonder why, but they separated themselves out from what was happening in Asia thousands of years ago, and they went northeast and they went southeast,
mm-hmm.
but way before Adam and Eve.
Right.
You know, and why were they leaving? I mean, there was lots of land. There weren't that many people back then. What kept them moving? And I am tempted to think that this philosophical disagreement between rights of property and there are no rights of property might have been the reason these people kept moving.
So perhaps some kind of rigid structure. Maybe we can call it a state. I don't know if that's quite fair. Have you ever read Against the Grain by James C. Scott?
No.
You might like that book.
Okay.
He argues essentially that because, let's say, sustainable cultures like tribal people oftentimes aren't building gigantic monolithic cities, etc., you know, these stone edifices and whatnot, they leave barely any trace of their own existence. They just kind of live across the land. All of their stuff biodegrades and it's gone, and we don't know about them and they're lost to history. And so he kind of writes about this interplay between the human race, which up until about 1600 was actually almost entirely tribal, with, you know, the exceptions are these big cities that we know. And basically all of our history is seen as if civilization, the city, is pretty much all that matters, and that all people basically live in the city. But in reality, until modernity, essentially, most people, maybe they weren't in, you know, tribes necessarily, but they were in small little villages with their own customs and whatnot. But the idea of the modern nation state is very recent.
Very new.
And people have been moving around. The idea of going native, you know, people get fed up with the city and say, I'm out of here. This sucks. Let's go do it the old fashioned way. Very interesting book. But anyway.
Tell me what it is again.
Against the Grain by James C. Scott. A large part of his argument actually has to do with the cultivation of wheat and how that was a major aspect. Basically, the book is about the rise of the stone civilization and wheat crops versus nomadic tribes and like permaculture adjacent types of agriculture. Very interesting. I don't remember exactly how I got onto that subject other than to say that what you're saying about the wandering tribes, and perhaps you're postulating that the reason they kept moving was because they were moving away from these system, these propertarian systems,
which were stone buildings,
right.
Permanent cities,
right.
Wheat agriculture. Gotcha.
Yeah. So yeah. Somebody sets himself up, maybe as king, maybe as god king, mm-hmm. and builds a great monument to himself in a city, and everyone there is essentially bound to him. And, you know, the characteristic trait of monarchy is private property in that everything is the king's property,
yes.
right, effectively. Including the people, right?
Which becomes the legitimacy for all other property.
Within the feudal system,
which is,
right.
But it's just like with our system, the government is the legitimizer of property.
Yeah, the government effectively will give its stamp of approval to what your property is in our current system. I think that property has a conceptual, philosophical existence as a phenomenon that is independent from state sanction. And my reasoning behind that is essentially due to the fact that we are embodied creatures. That the only thing in this world that I can say I've actually somehow come into, I've come to own, appears to be my body. Somehow, through some magical process, the non-material consciousness that I associate with myself seems to have control over this sack of material here. And that's what happens, right?
Yes.
So poof, we find ourselves in a body. By the nature of our bodies, we are limited spatially, temporally, cognitively, and in terms of our energy. We only have so much energy. We only have so much time. And I can only do so much with this body. Given that fact, what I do with my body becomes precious because I only have so much I can do with it in the grand scheme of things. So there's that. But then there's also the fact that because I phenomenologically can differentiate myself, my body, and my actions from yourself, your body, and your actions, we can essentially by playing with
that's an illusion.
Well, okay, that's fine. But it's a phenomenological reality that we seem, or let's not say reality. It's the phenomenology that we perceive we have to work within. I can't work without it. We can say it's an illusion, but damn, it's a persistent one.
Yes.
And it's the toys we're playing with.
True.
So I have to play within those constraints. It seems as if I live in a materially bound world.
But I do believe
with cause and effect.
That the conceptual constrictions that you are articulating now, yourself, can only know yourself, I think that is a conception of Western, European, Judeo-Christian, Greek thought development, and is not a strong force in some other cultures. Mm. And because of the sense of interdependence that is essential when you are living up against nature a little harder than we ever have.
Sure.
So that I don't exist without you. Mm-hmm. And you don't exist without me. And you could go on to the holographic theory. I mean, I don't exist without you, and you don't exist without... If you didn't exist, I wouldn't exist either.
Right.
Right?
Sure.
So, phenomenologically, we don't exist without this stuff either. Mm-hmm. And are we disconnected? You know, we're sharing air. We're connected. Everything,
right.
Everything is hooked up together. And this goes back to why I cannot legitimize the ownership of property.
Okay. I pretty much agree with all of that. I don't think what I'm saying contradicts it, though. I think that our oh, God, now I'm doing it. The role that I play and the role that you play within this grand unity, I think, manifests as individuation and individual action. We are social creatures. There is no me without the group that I come from. There's no individual without society, effectively. I'd also say there's no society without individuals, being that it's just a collection of individuals. They're reciprocating concepts. But I think at the same time, the individual playing a role within the grander system still has to be able to identify and can identify some semblance of cause and effect within the system, such that I know that by moving my arm in a certain way, I can lift that glass. I could choose to take a drink of water from it, or I can choose to throw it against the wall, or I can choose to hit you over the head with it.
Now, we don't want to go there.
Now, we don't want to get there. But in any case...
I don't even want your glass of water.
But in any case, I have to take responsibility for that action. It is my action. You didn't do it. Alice upstairs didn't do it. I did it. Now, we can construct a culture, and I think we should, that emphasizes each of us working together and using our actions that we own, for lack of a better, in order to further our prosperity. I wouldn't say maybe materially so much as, you know, our prosperity and virtue.
But is morality the right and wrong of your actions? Is that really you separate from others? I mean, this is a deep philosophical question.
Sure.
But I would say that in a group where somebody breaks the rules, mm-hmm. gets out of line, there's deep shame felt throughout the group. And so maybe my postulate would be that you threw that glass against the wall as a reaction to everything else that's happening around you.
Mm-hmm.
And everything around you is as culpable for your throwing that glass against the wall as you are.
Okay.
This I'm trying to break down ownership.
Right.
So you say, you know, you own your action. Well, you do, but you share your action. I mean, it's only, there's only morality when it involves more than one person.
Okay.
Are we going anywhere here?
Well, why? Does that, so let me be more specific with that question. Morality then is intrinsically based on interaction. There's no, if morality has to involve more than one person, you can't be immoral or moral by yourself in a vacuum.
But there is no such thing.
There's not. Right. So we're always in a group setting. We're always couched within a
even
society.
Even when you are by yourself in the bathroom.
So we are steeped in morality constantly then.
Sure.
Okay. So what then makes an action good or bad? And I'll let you answer, but I think this fundamentally has to do with the concept of property. But what is a good or a bad action?
Well, does it create harm?
Okay.
Does it harm somebody else? Does it limit somebody else's freedom? I mean, if we wanted to go back to the philosophers
mm-hmm.
and the relation of property and freedom, I know you'd probably want to get there. If it inhibits another person's freedom, then by matters of degree, it becomes immoral, like on a sliding scale.
Okay.
And if you take somebody else's food, you're injuring them.
Somebody else's okay. food.
But somebody, well, yeah, okay, I used the language. But can you imagine a culture in which there is no such thing as somebody else's food, and the moral foundation of that culture is that before that person would, or before I would take your food, you would offer me food. We've seen it happen all over the place all the time. People do that. So then why would there be any motive to steal food? Again, and then there has to be a motive behind property. What is your motive? And, I mean, if your motive is only to secure yourself, you're securing an illusion. Because you can't exist by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to start reading some quotations here pretty quick.
If you want to, sure. Well, I do want to ask, though,
okay.
about a hypothetical, let's say, group of people who they don't conceive of my food versus your food or anything like that. How far exactly does that sense of, I'm going to say the words communal ownership, but that's only because maybe we don't have a more precise term. If we're saying that there's no concept of ownership, which personally, I don't really think that makes sense.
No, I don't think that makes sense either.
Okay.
If I make a stone tool
mm-hmm. yes.
and you take it from me,
right.
I'm pissed.
Why?
Because I made a stone tool.
So?
If it is on you, if it is your personal thing, that kind of property, I can't argue with. But it happens on a scale.
Okay, but I am... Okay, so does it have to do with mixing your labor?
Does it have to... Well, you like that, mixing your labor.
Well, I wonder about that. I wonder if that is a factor for you in this.
Sure, but it doesn't have to be a tool I made. Maybe it was a tool somebody made for me.
Mm-hmm.
But these items like that, like my wallet, my phone, to be absurd, you know, my clothes, these are things you can't take from somebody. And so that's a kind of property.
But why not? If all you need to do is use a sense of communal well-being, you can justify pretty much anything, can't you? What if I steal your shirt to give it to somebody who I think deserves to have it more? What about that stone tool? You made it. You mixed your labor with the stone to create a tool. But I'm certainly spending some of my energy to steal it from you. Maybe we get into a fight.
But why didn't you just ask me for it?
Does it matter?
Yeah.
Why?
I'd rather you ask me.
Okay, but so you're implying then that there needs to be some kind of consent.
Exchange.
Exchange.
Yes.
So I think we're still coming back to property being something that we just can't avoid.
Well, I like to think in terms of nuance, in terms of scale. The further you get from yourself, the less right of ownership you have.
Okay.
Things that are closest to you, you have a right to ownership, things that you would physically defend, but things that you would walk away from and still assume, you know, I own the title to that house in Sheffield Lake.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I never see it and I never go there, it's still mine. That kind of ownership is way removed from you. And
sure,
is illegitimate. Property ownership, which is the distinction I tried to make at the beginning. Property ownership. You're living on a piece of land. You have a scalable right to defend your actions on that land. I mean, this is not 40 acres
right.
that you've got. If you were growing food, you would have a right to dictate here,
mm-hmm.
you know? And if anybody wanted to infringe on that, you would have to say, well, let me give you some food. You know, let's work out a deal.
Okay.
That would be, and I say a deal because I'm used to this.
Right. We got to work with the
exchange,
language we got.
Yes.
Yeah, I got you. I won't hold that against you.
Okay. Because I really think it's imaginary. It's utopia. But if we could conceive of a culture where other people's well-being is just as important as ours, and so if you're a stronger person and a luckier person, I've always been, you have an obligation to those who have less, and if who are not as strong, who are not as able, you have an obligation to improve their lives. And this goes back to feudalism, when you mentioned feudalism,
yeah.
You know, because the obligation of the big landowner was to make everybody's life better.
Sure.
And if he did, then you had a good functioning system.
Yeah.
I say he, because it was always almost.
So I started to pose a question, and I just want to complete the thought, which is, if we suppose there's a group of people who has no conception of ownership or property or anything like that, how far exactly can, and I mean can in a practical sense, how far is it reasonable to expect this group of people to extend that sense of egalitarianism or communal ownership, for lack of a better term? In other words, is it reasonable, and perhaps it is reasonable, to say that everyone within our small community of 100, 200, 500 people, we own everything in common? What about the other community across the hill? What about the people down by the river? Well, do they all also share from that common store? Is that other community entitled to our stuff in the same way that us living together are entitled to each other's?
No, space? And I think it that's related to the distance rule.
Okay.
Which I think that you have to subject ideas of property to that at-hand rule. Your immediate group of 500 is at hand.
Mm.
You're mutually subsistent. The people over the next hill, that group of 500, you have less obligation to them than you have to the people you live closest to.
Okay.
You have most obligation to your family,
mm-hmm.
right? Not yourself, but your family,
right.
And then your extended family, and then your village, your community.
Right.
But it doesn't stop.
Okay. Yeah, so I've seen variations on this idea expressed, but the idea of like concentric circles of responsibility,
yes.
or influence or whatever,
yes.
you want
and
to call
it. I've read different descriptions
yeah,
of it too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I like that. I mean, I've been wrestling in preparation for this conversation with how would I personally define property? And I'll probably, you know, as with everything I ever do, I'll probably change my mind at some point. But right now, the best I've got is something like property is that material which an individual has legitimate, exclusive control over and responsibility for. Something like that. So it cuts both ways. It's like, yes, the property is mine. I have the first right to it. That's my glass, so I get to use it or whatever. Or decide to give it away. It's my right, though. But that also means that if somehow that glass does injury to somebody, well, it's I'm the one who has to, you know, pay damages or whatever. I find it funny that oftentimes that responsibility half of property seems to escape more like conservative boilerplate conversations on the subject. You know, it's all about what I get to do with my shit. It's mine. But, you know, the being responsible for your actions part doesn't always enter into the conversation because it's less convenient, but whatever. We're not here to rag on right wingers, are we?
No. We're here to completely undermine them. But I would say that in terms of like a moral compass or moral equation, that if you take property out of the equation, then the moral question doesn't change. You don't have that I'm responsible for it because it was mine. It happened on my property. Mm-hmm. And it becomes everybody's responsible because it happened on our property, because it happened in our community.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I think I'm advocating for a very organic sense of community, interdependence. I was reading this afternoon, grazing for statements from Kierkegaard just to see what he might have said. And I lit on this Christian analysis of Kierkegaard in relation to property. And he went through the whole New Testament thing of give it away, give it away, give it away, man. And if you make that the ethic, the central ethic of your culture, selflessness, and I'm not saying I'm like this, but if you could create a culture like it, you can imagine it working very well. And I think it has. Mm-hmm. I think it has. And there's always going to be conflict. There are always going to be exceptions.
Yeah.
But we have serious problems on this planet now that were pretty much created by people who were saying, this is mine, this is mine, this is mine.
Well,
it's pretty much created by greed.
That's part of it. I also think that the state, given its monopoly on force in a given area, has been able to essentially give special permissions in exchange for favors to certain property holders over others, which I would say artificially and inorganically increases those property owners' influence. You know, we've essentially got a global oligarchy. I don't know that they have like formal meetings and acknowledge that that's what they are.
It's not very coherent.
No,
I don't think.
It's more of like a diffuse network of people who just have the most resources and the most influence.
They pretty much have the same religion.
Sure.
There's the same ethic.
But because of state power, those individuals, I think, have been allowed to thrive in a way that, absent the special ability to exert force or choose not to exert force in a more organic setting, I don't know that these types of people would have been able to rise to their position.
I agree with you on that. And that's why I don't think that we can have private property.
Okay.
In a peaceful, you know, egalitarian culture.
Okay.
And we're looking at world culture now, too.
Sure.
This is no longer, I mean, sorry about globalism. I didn't do it. But we are one planet now. I mean, you can't separate the concerns of somebody in Lagos from the concerns of somebody in Cleveland. And you can't say that these concerns are more important than those concerns. We're going to be sharing this little pill in the.
Well, hold on, though. What about our distance rule?
Well, I hear you.
Now, okay, well, if that's the case, then why can't I own a huge tract of land in Lagos? If I have to be concerned with the well-being of those people just as much as I would be for those of in my city, why isn't owning property there just as legitimate as me owning this house?
Because you can't be there.
So then how can I be concerned with the people of Lagos?
We have shrunk the planet so that we're not very far from Lagos. Lagos is that village over the hill.
Okay.
And in a give it away man world, our role, because we have more, would be to do whatever is best for the people in Lagos. That would be the moral imperative.
I've heard that kind of argument before. D- do.
Well, it doesn't necessarily. It doesn't work very well. granted, but we're also struggling with the whole European hegemonic system that has led to globalist elites. You know, the whole Cartesian set of ideas, the whole Aristotelian set of ideas have led us to this point. They've been the guiding formulas for the development of our culture, the culture that has become hegemonic over the world. And look what's going on. Look at Putin in Ukraine. Look at the Mexican border. There's a good example of what the hell is wrong with property. There's a good example of what's wrong with borders. We're in a country that is experiencing a labor shortage, if the economy is important to you. It's, again, something we could argue about. But we're keeping all of these very determined people, people willing to walk 1,000 miles through violent territory in order to try to get here. And we need people like that, but we're going to keep them out because this is ours. Mm-hmm. It's not ours. That's a myth.
Well, right. So when we come to that issue, now we're talking, I think, less about property, though it's relevant, but more about the nation state. Let's draw back to a smaller, maybe more workable example of our community of 500 people who share everything in common and are, on that basis, self-sufficient. Now, let's say that other people from elsewhere start to enter into this 500-people community. Naturally, these people require resources. It's conceivable, arguably, that there will reach a point where we just don't have enough resources anymore to continue being one unit, right? So as the group grows and grows and grows, either it's going to have to break apart, split into two groups, or it's going to have to say, look, we're going to have to start kicking people out or not taking any more newcomers, because it becomes a resource distribution and allocation problem, right? Because there's not just infinite shit, right? And there's not infinite, maybe there is potentially infinite food within the ground, but there's not infinite energy and laborers to actually pull it out and realize that, right? So this is maybe a completely different conversation, but, you know, I fundamentally agree with you on the absurdity of national borders. My only concern would be bringing people in and then essentially giving them the benefits of a welfare state. You know what I mean? Because that'll just draw from the pool of resources until eventually the thing seems like it'll collapse.
Well, my whole point was that these are people who are more motivated than the people who are already living here.
Well, that's true.
To do. And doing always adds value to a community. I mean, you can do the wrong things, but yeah, we're shooting ourselves in the foot in that sense. But I think there's another factor that comes into this before I get to my little gleaning of quotes about private property. There's another thing that comes into this, which is, and I tend to trust the demographers because they're working with the big numbers, you know, the big pictures. And 2100, while you're daughter is probably still going to be alive, we will have seen peak human population, and it will probably never peak that high again. And all of the incentives, like that resource, running out of resources and resource allocation, that whole factor in this property conversation starts to change. And that's only 100 years away, dude. Humanity will be here. I don't care if we have a nuclear war or whatever. Humans are going to be here. And so we have to wonder, how can we take advantage of that to change the way we relate with each other? Because we're not happy with it right now. I mean, I can tell you, we're not happy with it, the way we relate to each other. Republicans can't talk to Democrats. And Ukrainians can't talk to Russians. And it goes on and on all over the world. We're not happy with this model that we're living with. And I do think that peak population will be a huge opportunity for humanity. And it's not going to change the fact that it's the Anthropocene. We dominate the planet to a ridiculous degree. But we can change our relationship with each other, and we can change our relationship then with the world around us, which, you know, I want to get to where, like, my characters are always searching for that point where, isn't that rock part of my community? The bird, everything is part of my community. So that you have, you know, you could say empathy, but it wouldn't really be experienced as empathy. I don't think that animals experience their relation to other animals and to the trees. I don't think they experience as empathy. I think they experience it as a oneness, as an everythingness. And I think that this is just where I like to go off speculatively. Humans, in our brilliance, somewhere around 6,000 years ago, maybe it was the Anunnaki. We don't know.
Hell yeah.
But somebody got the bright idea that we could think of ourselves as individuals and we could create languages that refer to a thing outside of us, separated us from that thing by naming it. Just like you can't name God, right? Yahweh, the Old Testament ban on naming God. The sure. reason they do that is so that you can't claim God.
Mm-hmm.
Same reason I don't believe in property. You can't claim property. We name all of the other elements in the world around us obsessively. And in doing so, separate them from ourselves. We make it us and then that. Mm-hmm. And that's language. I do believe it's possible that humanity is happier back there 20,000 years ago, participatory in everything, without that distinction that you were talking about. My phenomenological me doesn't exist. I exist as part of everything else. So that's my final position on the property thing. Nobody owns anything. Rousseau said it. What did he say? Now it's time to go to the
quotes. Go for it.
Go to the quotes. Start with Rousseau. That was the last one I picked up, I think. The first man, having enclosed a piece of ground, bethought himself of saying, "This is mine," and found people simple enough to believe him. He was the founder of civil society. From how many crimes, wars, and murders, from how many horrors and misfortunes, might not anyone have saved mankind by pulling up the stakes or filling up the ditch and crying to his fellows, "Beware of listening to this impostor. You are undone if you once forget that the fruits of the earth belong to us all and the earth itself to nobody." It's beautiful. Thomas Jefferson is interesting on almost every subject. So is Will Durant. He said, "Property was the mother, war was the father of the state." You know that one?
I do. I love Durant.
Yeah, I think, and that, you know, war was the father. I think that's the violence required in order to maintain a system of property.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you ever hear, "When Adam delved and Eve span, who then was the gentleman?" That's, it's either John Ball or Jack Straw back in 1381, during the English Peasants' Revolt, essentially arguing against nobility, and fundamentally they argued against property. Very interesting. So thought I'd add that.
You have to repeat it.
"When Adam delved and Eve span, who then was the gentleman?" So the idea being that we're all descendants of Adam and Eve. What then is the basis for hierarchical valuations of humans based on birth?
Essentially. Yeah.
But it's kind of tangential, but they did talk also about property.
Understood. Understood. I have trouble with the conservative and libertarian notion. Here I got Ayn Rand and Calvin Coolidge. Property rights and personal rights are the same thing.
Mm.
I can imagine granting everyone the same human rights as I have without any conception of property. In other words, you should be born into this world with the expectation that you will be fed. That's not the way we operate.
No.
That's the way I think we should operate. I have been pissed off since I was 3 or 4 years old by the notion that somehow I was brought into this world.
Right.
And I got a plan on paying rent. Right. You know, or I have to own property. And I've always thought it was an injustice. I mean, for me, life is easy. But there are millions of people for whom life is not easy.
Sure.
And they're born into that state. And no wonder people kill themselves. The demands are ridiculous. And you have to love that shit. You have to be a greedy motherfucker to make it. So again, so that at the gut level, that's where I reject property on a philosophical level.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how I get back around to the 100 acres in Canada. But,
well, but okay, so we're kind of oscillating, I think, between the idea where you're saying that you don't like the idea of property, you think it's illegitimate, and that ownership is sort of at the root of a lot of our problems. But you're also saying that you do think there is a legitimacy to property based on your spatial rule, the distance law, let's call it.
Yeah.
So which is it? Because you're acknowledging some form of ownership, and in doing so, you're acknowledging some kind of causal connection between the property and the individual who's said to own it.
Well, maybe ownership is the wrong word.
Okay.
In other words, there were a couple of good examples that I picked up this week. The one was the hammer. You know, if I put down the hammer, I have a right to expect that when I go back to that hammer, I can pick it up and use it.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't pick it up and use it if somebody came and borrowed it and they're going to bring it back.
That still implies property. Consent. It borrowed.
Well, yeah. Yeah, but that's an item. That's a hand item.
Mm-hmm.
You lay the hand item down, it becomes less yours. You walk away, it becomes less yours. You know, you leave it there for a year, it's not yours anymore at all. I mean, I think that's pretty self-explanatory. But when you have that, you've got your property, you've got your privacy fence, and you've got your neighbor, and you've got your apple tree growing next to the privacy fence, and your apple tree spans over the privacy fence, and an apple grows on your neighbor's side of the fence. Whose apple is it?
Right.
Yeah, that's Hodgson, I think, describing Kant. That's an interesting apple.
Right.
And I think he used an apple for a reason.
And if the apple falls onto the neighbor's property, can you eat it or can he sue you?
Can he sue?
You've damaged my grass. I've got to ask, well, actually, there are two things I definitely want to ask. One, have you read Agrarian Justice by Thomas Paine?
No.
You might want to check into that.
That's not in that volume that you printed. Is it in there?
It is.
I haven't gotten to it yet.
Okay, dig it. It's short. It's maybe like 14 pages or something.
Okay.
He wrote it, I want to say in 1796 or 7, so kind of in the midst and aftermath of him witnessing the French Revolution firsthand. Essentially, it's one of the first tracts concerning what's now called Georgism, but the idea that you are entitled to the fruits of your labor, but not the resource itself that you melded your labor with. So, for instance, I can grow potatoes in the dirt, and then I could say, I own the potatoes, and we can exchange for the potatoes, but I can't own the land.
That's a nice distinction.
And he used that as a basis for essentially saying that in a community, because we're effectively renting the land itself from everybody, then we all have to pay into a commonwealth. And he basically wrote about a welfare state with, you know, not an extreme welfare state, but giving everyone, you know, $1,000 on their 21st birthday or whatever.
The word is usufruction.
Usufruction.
Usufruction. Usufruction.
Okay.
That is the use of the land without the ownership. And it's not challenged, it's not paid for. That term is it's a Catholic Church term.
Wow.
So there were people who had usufructory rights on Catholic land. And when people came and started taking land from Native Americans, they said they had usufructory rights, but they didn't have ownership rights. So, like, people could buy the land or, you know, claim the land from underneath them. Right. You only have use of factory rights. And the church, I mean, there's, I want to say, a papal bull, but it's being challenged in Canada right now by the native people. It's from the 15th century.
The donation? Might that be it?
No.
The donation of Alexander the Fourth?
No.
14th?
No.
Okay.
But it pertained because it was at the beginning of the period of exploration, and it pertained to the assumption of native lands. And the, you know, if you're not using it, it's not yours. Mm-hmm. And usufruction is you're using the land. So they would look at a great big a wilderness and say, well, you're only using that little area. But the fact is people were moving and they had the right to move over a certain area. And, you know, native people negotiated this stuff among themselves.
Mm-hmm.
The borders there, you have your trap line, you have your, you know, up north, the dotem. And the Europeans just, again, we're looking for ways to create legalese that would make it possible to take it out from underneath them.
Yeah. So I'm not familiar with that exact instance of usufruction, but I love the word and I'll really try to use it just because it sounds fun.
Just look for some references to it. And it's a good word when it comes to this question of land property.
Right. Well, and there's such a blatant contradiction too. So the instance I am familiar with, although I don't remember the exact title, but it was made in like 1495 or something, which was essentially the Pope after Columbus's voyage in 1492, you know, he discovers, you know, an island. And basically the Pope was like, well, great. On this basis, we will grant property rights over everything we haven't discovered yet to the Spanish and Portuguese governments. So two continents, the Pope was like, oh, well, it's theirs now. So, like, to me, if you can do that, but then you can't say that the natives owned land that they weren't using to your satisfaction when the Spaniards hadn't even begun to use any of it.
Yeah, well, that was just bullshit.
It's crazy, right? Papal bullshit.
All right, I'm going to read a couple more of these.
Okay.
Marx, the theory of communism. I already said that one. I thought that Schopenhauer, if there is anything that can really be called a man's property, it is surely that which is the result of his mental activity. So that relates to the closer it is to you, the more it is yours. Schopenhauer is taking that to its extreme. The truest property you have is your thoughts.
Yes, which is why I don't like Elon. I'm sorry, everybody.
I don't like Elon either.
He scares the shit out of me with that brain chip.
Yeah, exactly. Fred Allen, I don't want to own anything that doesn't fit in my coffin.
Ooh, I like that one.
Yeah, I like that one, too. Have you ever heard of Pierre Joseph Proudhon?
I have. I read a little bit of him.
Yeah, property is theft.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you can justify that.
I would have liked a better argument from him. But
I just like the directness of it. I mean, because when you claim that piece of property, then it doesn't belong to anybody else anymore. You just stole it from everybody. That's an anarchist.
Yes.
Yeah.
Not cool with Marx.
And then in the website I was looking at right after they land, they have Fernando Pessoa, who says, property is not theft. It is nothing. He's like a Taoist, you know.
Yep.
I like John Steinbeck. The quality of owning freezes you forever in I and cuts you off forever from we. Yeah. Okay. That's what I'm talking about.
So that's
about
where you're aiming.
Yeah.
Okay.
Frank Zappa, the only difference between a cult and a religion is the amount of real estate they own. Anyway, I wanted to get that stuff out. If you guys want to read my novels, this is Jay Clark. And the novel I have that you could buy, bound, and with a cover by Danny's wife, my daughter, is No Bottom Road. And if you would like a copy of it, you can contact Danny at his website.
Yeah. So storyofnowhere@mail.com. The same contact site or the same contact email for any other correspondence. Email me that and in the subject line, just write Jay's book or property guy's book. Any of that. Anything will do. I'll read it.
Yeah.
And we'll get you a copy.
Absolutely. And I got another one that's going to come off the presses pretty soon. And I don't have a title set yet, but Dan, I love you. This is my son-in-law I'm talking to here.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we're really happy to be able to do this stuff, and keep listening.
Hell yeah, thanks. Well, thank you for doing it, and everyone, be sure to check out Jay's book, No Bottom Road. I haven't read the new one yet, but I read the first one, and I really, really recommend it. So check it out. Hit me up. We'll get you a copy. Thank you.
I roamed and rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond deserts. All around me, a voice was a-sounding. This land was made for you and me. There was a big high wall there that tried to stop me. A sign was painted, said private property. But on the backside, it didn't say nothing. This land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling. And the wheat fields waving, and the dust cloud rolling. A voice was chanting as the fog was lifting. This land was made for you and me. This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.